the problem of yoga practice is a single and concentrated problem right from the beginning till the end. It is that elusive something which we call the object of our quest. The whole of life is an effort at obtaining, acquiring, or possessing, or enjoying, or becoming one with what we seek. Now this is the precise foundation of not merely yoga, but every kind of effort anywhere in the world. How are you going to possess the object of your quest? Difficulties in the practice of yoga, difficulties in any kind of success in the world, arise on account of not knowing the method and the means of properly contacting the object of quest. And coming in union with it for the purpose of the satisfaction that one seeks through such a union. The object of quest in yoga is similar to any other object of quest in the world in secular life, as far as the difficulty in acquiring it or possessing it is concerned, though the nature of the object is quite different in different cases. How will you possess anything? We have a very unclear notion of possession, search, enjoyment, etc. We are born with an unclear notion about things, and we die with an unclear notion about all things. And therefore all our struggle and effort throughout life is based on misconception about things in general. And a misconception about one thing is equivalent to a misconception about any other thing. Because there is only one object of quest. And if there is any other object of quest, than the one which we are having in front of our mind's eye, it will be presenting before us a similar problem. Because the problem is a scientific one. It is not a social problem or even an ordinary psychological problem in the academic sense. It is a very difficult thing to be very precise in the understanding of things, because the mind is always in a hurry in acquiring its object of quest, and it is not enough if you are merely seeking an object and be in a hurry about it. It is also necessary to properly acquire a knowledge of the means thereof. This means or the method of acquiring or possessing the object of quest is directly concerned with our relationship with that object. And there is nothing more difficult to understand in this world than this peculiar thing called relationship. But we may ignorantly imagine that relationship is something very clear. There is nothing difficult about it. I am related to this person, he is my brother. What is the difficulty? The relationship is very clear. This is my father. This is my sister. This is my brother-in-law. This is my boss. This is my peon. This is the relationship. What is your problem about knowing relationship? But this sort of an answer to this peculiar question is no answer. That is a child's answer to a very scientific problem. And unless this question is clearly answered in one's own mind, the object of quest will not come near us, it will recede, like the horizon. The more you approach the horizon, the further it will recede from you. You will never touch the horizon, whatever be the effort you make in running towards it. The object of quest runs away from that person who does not understand it properly, says the Upanishad. It will be very strange. The object of your quest runs away from you instead of coming near you if you do not understand it and if you have a wrong notion about it. And unfortunately, we have a wrong notion about it. What is our notion about a thing? An object. I have attempted to give some idea about this subject sometime earlier. Our idea is that everything is disconnected. We have an ambivalent attitude, as I mentioned last time, which means to say that we have a double personality in ourselves, which emphasizes one thing on one at one time and another thing at another time. We like and dislike a thing at the same time. This is called a psychological tension. You may wonder, how is it possible to like and dislike a thing at the same time? But this is exactly what our attitude is towards things. That is why sometimes you look all right, sometimes you do not look all right. To recall to your memories what I mentioned some time back, a few days ago, this double attitude of ours towards an object is born of a peculiar structure of our personality. We have two realms of being implanted in us, the eternal and the temporal. And these two realms are working simultaneously in us. And there is a warfare going on, as it were, between these two values of the two realms. This is, to repeat again, the Mahabharata war, taking place everywhere, inside me, inside you, inside everyone, everywhere in creation. The battle between the eternal and the temporal is called the epic war of the Mahabharata. Sometimes they call it in the Puranic language the war between the gods and the titans or the demons, etc. Pressure of diversity and the pressure of unity. These are the two aspects which work simultaneously in us and in everyone in the, and everything in the world. While the senses, eyes, ear, nose and all the apparatus of perception insist on a diversity of things. Because unless there is diversity, there is no such thing as seeing, hearing, etc. And because the senses have an egoism of their own, they want to assert themselves and keep up their chairs intact. They affirm a diversity of things. Otherwise their chairs will be pulled out. They have no set status. Because they have no function to perform and there is no diversity. They will die out. But who will like to die out? Everybody would like to live as long as possible. So, I maintain my position by hook or crook. This is what the senses do. So, assertion of diversity is the primary activity of the senses. And we are wedded to the senses. We are living in a sensory world. We are slaves of the eyes, ears, nose, etc. We are not masters thereof. Whatever the eyes say, we believe. The eyes say there is a wall, I say yes, there is a wall. What a slavish mind I have got. Merely because the eyes tell me that there is a wall, I say yes, there is a wall. That means I am a servant of the eyes. I am not a master. And my finger touches something, oh, there is a desk. Yes, I agree with it. Yes, yes, there is a desk. That means I am a slave of the sense of touch. Why should I believe this sense? Because my finger feels something and says there is a desk. In combination with the perception of the eyes, both of which have connived together to create a conspiracy to deceive me, I agree with them and say, very good, there is a desk here. So my intelligence only this much. Whatever be my rationality, understanding, it is a slavish rationality, very culpable and really unbecoming of the dignity of the soul of man, of which he is boasting so much. We are in a sensory world throughout root and branch. So we assert diversity. Who can say there is no desk here? Every sensible man will say there is a desk. And if I say there is no desk, you will call me fool, an insane person. His brain is out of order. That is what he will think. Because everybody lives in a sensory world and the sensational appreciation of things is regarded as the highest of rationality. So this is one side of our problem. But you don't know the consequences of this. Acquiescing ourselves in the reports of the senses. What is the consequence? You have taken for granted that there is diversity in the world. Otherwise you will not say there is a desk, there is a man, there is this, that and all that. So all our philosophy finally has ended in the decree, which is inviolable, that there are sense objects and one object has no connection with the other. But why is it that you are pulled towards an object? I have already mentioned all this last time, I am only repeating it for your memory. Why is it that you are pulled towards an object? Who is it that pulls you? If there is no connection between you and the object. You have already decreed that there is no connection of one thing with another thing by agreeing with your senses that everything is discrete, there is diversity in the world. But now you have to answer me another question. Who is it that pulls you towards an object? Not the object, because the object has no connection with you. Already you have declared the discrete existence or the isolated existence of one thing unconnected with the other. There cannot be a pull of one thing in respect of another if everything is disconnected. Now you have to answer this question. Why is there a pull? Why I am pulled towards you, you are pulled towards me? Why A is pulled towards B, B towards A, etc.? Why there is a talk of collaboration and universal brotherhood and organization? Why should there be any such thing as symmetry of action and methodology of approach? Why should there be anything like this in a world of absolutely disconnected things? So there is another thing speaking from beginners. While the senses say everything is different and therefore we will assert the diversity of things, something else tells it is not so. You have a connection with things and therefore I shall not leave you in peace. We are caught between the devil and the deep sea. Between one thing telling you that you have a connection with other things, therefore I shall pull you towards it, which is called love and hatred. And another thing telling you, I shall assert diversity and one thing has no connection with another thing. So we are in the middle, listening to that voice sometime, listening to this voice at other time. Now the practice of yoga is a master stroke which is dealt at the root of this problem. And any other educational technique will not be able to solve this mystery. All the qualifications of educational institutions of the top degree will not be able to solve this mystery. We have been placed in this dilemma since centuries, and even today we are in the same difficulty. We love a thing and hate a thing at the same time because we have two aspects in us. The aspect of unity which calls for love and the aspect of diversity which urges us to disregard that unity aspect. So there is affirmation of egoism and the expression of anger, wrath and a tendency to battle when we lean too much upon the diversity aspect of things. And there is a great feeling for oneness of mankind, unity of things, etc. when we listen to the other aspect that is in us. Now are we to go on like this forever, drifting with the wind that blows as it pleases? Or have we a say in this matter? The yoga technique is the method of gaining control over these various forces which up to this time have swayed over us and made us they are subjects. The yogi is not a subject of anybody. He is a master. He does not wish to be a slave of forces. And he is awakened to the consciousness that he is connection with things is such that he need not be a slave for all times. He has a place in the parliament of the cosmos, as it were, and he is not merely a subjected slave of this universal government. Or we may say he has a place, a voice in the government of the universe. To this fact he is awakened by the knowledge of yoga. He is not merely a puppet in the hands of forces over which he has no control. And these two aspects are brought together into focus in the preliminary steps of yoga, even, not merely in the advanced stages. Because unless this point is made the pivot of activity in the practice of yoga, we may miss our aim and go astray hither and thither. One of the most important factors to remember in this connection is that our aim is very clear. We know the direction in which we have to move, and there is no use or need asking people which way to move. The direction has been pointed out already, and the aim also is clear before the mind. We have a personality which is complicated in nature on account of this peculiar thing that I mentioned. We have what we call the soul or consciousness, which asserts its indivisibility of character. And we have a biological personality, which seeks for objective satisfaction in the world of space and time and regards itself as a helpless tool in this world of diversity. We are slaves from the point of view of the body, but masters from the point of view of the soul. So are we masters or slaves? This is a very peculiar thing. We have got two aspects combined in us. There is, therefore, the necessity to rise from bodily subjectivity to the mastery of the soul, stage by stage in the practice of yoga. Even the first step, the asana, the position of the posture, is the preparation for this mastery that you have to gain in the practice of yoga. The padmasana or sukhasana or some such posture that you assume in the practice of yoga is itself a very great step and not an ordinary step that you have taken. Because the stability of the body at once stabilizes the biological forces of our personality. Yesterday or some days back I mentioned that we are not persons or bodies, we are centers of force. We are not Mr. So-and-so or Mrs. So-and-so as we are imagining. These are wrong notion of things. We are only centers of force. Energy is circling, and rotating, revolving in a particular manner, whirling in a particular direction for a purpose. We are like eddies in the ocean of power. This is something our present mind, present state of mind cannot understand. You are calling me a center of energy, force. I am not Rama, Krishna, Gopala, Govinda, Jack, John. I am thinking like that. You are saying that I am something else. But you are precisely that. What you call chapati is only a heap of particles of wheat flour. They are spread over in a particular manner. And you have given it a name, chapati, because it has assumed a shape. There is no such thing as chapati. It is only small grains of wheat flour stuck together by some means. The whole building is nothing but a conglomeration of small pieces called bricks. You don't call it a heap of bricks. You call it only building. You have given it another name altogether. Palace, mahal and all that you call. But really it is a heap of bricks. Small stones kept one over the other. You can as well say here is a pattern of small pieces of bricks. Instead of saying it is a palace. But you have given it another name for a convenience of your own. We are made up of such small elements, microbes, cells, atoms, centers of force and energy, and we are neither a man nor a woman. All these are false notions into which we have been born and with which we are bred up. And due to this prejudice thinking, we are caught up in what we call the samsara. We are only particular centers of energy. And this asana practice, to come to the point, is a first step that you take to attune yourself to the atmospheric condition of the forces outside. So that the condition of the forces which constitute this bodily personality is set in harmony with the very same forces which are external to us. It is as if a small drop or a wave in the ocean tries to tune itself with the vast ocean, the Pacific or the Atlantic, of which this little small wave is made. But if the wave is to concentrate itself on its own little small localized individuality, it will forget that it belongs to the Pacific. I am a child of the Atlantic. It does not know that. It thinks I am a small little particle of water. But yoga is this little small particle awakening itself to the consciousness, oh, I am the Atlantic, I am the ocean of the Pacific. But it is really that. It is not gaining any new knowledge or making a new discovery. It has forgotten that it is Atlantic by itself. Such a terrific thing it is. But it is looking like a small drop because of self-affirmation. So yoga is a gradual, systematized technique of overcoming the prejudice of self-affirmation, egoistic assertion of the bodily individuality, towards which the first step is the asana. The confused movements of the body, the chaotic postures we assume are put into a proper order and we refuse to be chaotic anymore and we make a determination to be systematic from today onwards. And the first system was considered by us earlier as that of the social harmony we established by the practice of the yamas, ahimsa, satya, asteya, brahmacharya, parigraha, etc. And now we come to the personal aspect of this discipline from the social aspect, by which we refuse to give undue credit to the affirmations of the body in its clamorings for satisfaction, and with an educational psychology applied, we bring down the pressure of the ego upon the body and allow oneself to get harmonized with a larger and larger approach to things, which is, in other words, a growing into wider and wider forms of unselfishness. The more you advance in the practice of yoga, the more you become unselfish, which means to say, you get into the realm of a wider self. It doesn't mean that you are losing yourself. Unselfishness is not loss of self. It is a transcendence of the lower self in gaining mastery through the higher self. So unself means no self, or in the present context it means the gaining of mastery over the lower self by the higher self. Because when you rise to the higher self, you need not think of the lower one, because the lower one is already included in the higher. All the values that you find in the lower self are found in the higher in a transmuted and rarefied form. So we come to the recognition of the importance of the practice of posture, asana, in the practice of yoga, whose spiritual connotation I have tried to place before you today. Hari Om.